From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, if the Trump administration gets its way, the 2020 census will have a question about your citizenship status.
I really see that this is one more measure of intimidation of minorities and immigrant groups.
Hollywood actress Toni Trucks on the magic of her hometown.
Manistee really encouraged me and supported me and told me yes all the time as a little person. And I think that having that energy as my foundation as an artist was so special.
Plus, how to talk to loved ones about mental health.
Whenever we have secrecy about something, secrecy leads to shame, shame leads to stigma.
And what happens when people talk typewriter. Those stories and more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Coming up later this hour, how do you know when it's time to seek mental health treatment?
Some of the most severe mental health issues come along with the baggage of low insight, and that you don't realize how much your functioning has changed or what is going on or what has gone wrong.
But first, if the Trump administration gets its way, the 2020 census will have something that hasn't been on a census in 70 years, a question about your citizenship status. And that has critics on high alert. They fear the question will keep non-citizens and legal immigrants from responding to the census. And they say an inaccurate head count is bad for their communities and for Michigan. With us now, Hassan Jaber. He's executive director and CEO of Access, the Arab Community Center for Economic and Social Services. It's located in Dearborn. Hassan, what were your first thoughts when the Trump administration made this announcement about the 2020 census to say it will ask people whether or not they're American citizens?
I had fears before the announcement regarding how much we can engage immigrant community, especially with this climate. And when the decision to include the question of citizenship came in, this became a very, very troubling and frankly challenging issue for us as a community when
Why?
It comes to we here in Michigan, 40% of our state budget comes from the federal government based on the census, based on the data from the census. Frankly, many of the very critical programs, including Medicaid, Medicare, including schools, including infrastructures, will be gravely impacted if Michigan does not have a full count. I think this question of including citizenship is going to add to hesitation, to it's going to add to the fear of immigrants regarding participation in the 2020 census. I think the fact that this hasn't been a tested question is very troubling in terms of what impact including this question will be on the accuracy and reliability of the census. I think that taking into consideration the environment, the political environment, the anti-immigrant sentiments that comes from the Trump administration can only lead to discouraging many, many immigrant and hard-to-count communities, including minorities, in participation in the 2020 census.
When you stop to think, the last time that citizenship question was on the U.S. Census was 1950. The 1960 census just asked about place of birth, but not citizenship. From where you sit, what do you see when this question could be added for 2020? What is it you're seeing?
I really don't see a benefit in adding the question. First of all, I haven't seen any justification for adding the question. And till we know what are the justifications from the Trump administration, and we haven't heard this yet. And secondly, we know that this climate of intimidation of minorities and immigrants adding of the question adds much more fears and hesitations. And the fact that really that since 1950, the question was taken out of the census also call into question the how constitutional is this proposal by the Trump administration to add a citizenship question, especially with the fact that the American Community Survey, which is an ongoing survey by the census, do ask citizenship question. So what's the justification? What's the reason? What's behind all of this? Knowing that this question was not being tested in terms of how it impact response to the census. So,
what do you think the reason is?
I really see that this is one more measure of intimidation of minorities and immigrant groups. I see that it's a way of excluding these populations. I see that it's a way of creating additional concerns and fears among these populations. And I really do not see any benefit in terms of how we can enhance census data reliability and, frankly, integrity of the data.
Hassan, there are people who will insist the United States has a right to know who is here, be it citizens or non-citizens. And they feel if groups of people choose to not fill out the census form, that's their problem. How do you respond to that?
First, it's we do have the rights. These information are available. These information are being collected by the American Community Survey, which is a census.
So you mean the citizenship information?
The citizenship information. So really the logic and justification for including the question is not there. And on top of that, the process that census goes through to include a question on the census is a very exhaustive process. This question has not been vetted by the process. And it really need for us to come back to a reasonable conversation, a real less fear conversation about the makeup of our population and how we really understand who's in the country and what are the needs out there.
There's a group of state attorneys general, not Michigan's attorney general, who are suing to keep this citizenship question off the census form. How confident are you in the outcome of that lawsuit?
I really believe that this question can be challenged on constitutional basis. This question can be challenged in terms of the process and not going through the vetting process and not going through the what census needs to steps that needs to be taken to make sure that the question is reliable question and also the fact that there is cost added to including this question in a time when the census budget is shrinking and less funding is out there, in a time when privacy and confidentiality is now being tested and a concern not only among immigrant groups but among almost everyone in the population. So in terms of the damage that can cause for lack of reliable, accurate census data, damage to communities, to representation, to benefit to communities. So I think that there are some very, very solid ground to push back on this decision.
What's your message to people within the Arab American community about the 2020 census? As we're talking right now with things up in the air, and it appears that this question is coming, what's your message to them?
The census is about representation. The census is about inclusion. The census is about fairness to communities. And the census is about programs and well-being of communities. So for all of that, despite the challenges, despite the fear, we need to participate in the census. And we need to continue to fight while participating that there need to be the protection and confidentiality and the privacy of all communities need to be protected. So on one hand, we still need not to give up on participating in the census and also not to give up on protecting the privacy of all communities.
Hassan Jaber, Executive Director and CEO of Access. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
I, Gerald R. Ford, do grant.
The other passengers very reluctantly gave up their seats, but I refused.
The young man makes up his mind to work. There's no limit to what he can do.
This is truly the next chapter in General Motors' recovery and turnaround.
You're living at a time of extremism, a time of revolution.
Each week here on Stateside, we talk about important, significant moments from our state's history. We've talked about things like how and when snowboarding began, what led to a small town's pizza funeral, and who broke baseball's color barrier before Jackie Robinson. But now we turn to you. Is there anything weird, unusual, interesting from Michigan's history that you're curious about? Do you have any life experiences you think that historians would get a kick out of? We'd love to hear your ideas. You can leave us a voicemail at 734-764-7840. Here's the number again, 734-764-7840. Or send us your ideas at the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Your career may take you out of Michigan, but Michigan still holds a place in your heart. And that's certainly the case with Michigan-born and raised actors. They might wind up working in New York or Hollywood, but they make sure the world knows they're from Michigan. Jeff Daniels, Tim Allen, Kristen Bell, and my guest, Toni Trucks. She's been in a host of movies and TV shows, including her current role as Lisa Davis in SEAL Team on CBS. And for her, it all started in Manistee. And now she's lending her voice to help her hometown. Toni Trucks, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here.
Well,
what a warm welcome.
We're happy to have you here. And I read, tell me if I read correctly, your first time on stage was at the Ramsdell Regional Center for the Arts in Manistee.
That's correct.
How old were you and what was the role?
I was 7 or 8, and I was just in the chorus of Sweet Charity. And so I was just in the ensemble waving in the background and couldn't have been happier.
And the bug bit.
And the bug bit. I actually had seen a production of Most Happy Fella with my father, and there was a little girl that came by, I think, wheeling on a cake or something, and I was like, I did not get the memo that they were looking for little girls. How is this not me? And luckily, I had a really supportive father who ran downstairs and said, when's the next audition for the plays? And it was the next day, and so he took me, and the rest is history.
And I know that you're in L.A. now. When and why did you decide to do that?
Well, you know, I've been so supported by Michigan institutions, so, you know, Manistee really fostered and encouraged me and then kicked me out of the nest to Interlochen. Mm-hmm. And so I graduated from Interlochen. Interlochen then kicked me out of the nest to the University of Michigan. So I went to University of Michigan's musical theater program, and they lovingly made a beautiful gateway for me to go to New York and get an agent right away. So mm-hmm. I went to New York first because I wanted to do Broadway. And my agent there, after 2 years, sent me out for a random TV show. And I booked it and moved to Los Angeles and started a totally different career that I had not expected.
It's interesting. And I think you do see a lot of people out of Michigan find that home in the theater. And Kristen Bell was in the theater. You did theater. Jeff Daniels started got caught up in movies and couldn't wait. I remember him telling me, once the kids got old enough, I'm going back to New York. And indeed, he did.
Yeah.
And you've worked steadily. I mean, your IMDb page, I checked it out. You have 39 credits, including Twilight Saga, Breaking Dawn Part 2. That cracking Hollywood, you went out, you said, you almost sound surprised. I booked it.
Yeah.
This show.
Sure. Yeah. Well, it was not what I expected. I thought I just wanted to do Broadway. I was like Broadway bound, and kept doing regional theater around in and around New York. So to all of a sudden be like, in 2 weeks, you must be at Paramount Studios in Los Angeles. You're living in a hotel and here's your golf cart. You know what I mean? You're sort of like, what is happening?
Wow.
So it's very exciting. But, you know, I don't know why Michigan fosters such vibrant performers. We just pump them out, you know. And James Earl Jones is also from Ramsdale Theater. And we actually got some exciting news while I was home last week that James Earl Jones has lent his voice to the theater. So we are the only American theater to have James Earl Jones welcoming Manistee audiences to every production.
Oh, good heavens.
And telling him to turn off your cell phone.
And you know, if James Earl Jones tells you, you will do that.
You will do it.
And here you've gotten involved in this big effort promoting Manistee's historic trademark or landmarks, and you've done a load of narration for a series of videos. How are these videos used, Tony?
Manistee County Visitors Bureau has made this beautiful comprehensive historic tour. There's actually 100 different sites on the tour. We have to date recorded about 30 different voiced tours that you can see online. So if you're walking around Manistee and perhaps you come to a building that is privately owned or you can't get into for whatever reason, there's a QR code that you can scan with your phone and it'll take you to a virtual tour that I've voiced. And so there's about 30 of those. Those are separated up into 8 themed tours. And there's also an app you can get on your phone. If you go to any of your app stores, go to Manistee County. It'll pop right up and you can take a virtual tour from anywhere in the world if you want.
Why do you love Manistee so much?
You know, my dad and I were trying to dissect this the other day. He's like, you just love old buildings. And I always have. You would think growing up around them that I would maybe perhaps not really see them as much. But for some reason, I've always been so enamored with them. And Manistee, I think, really sweats this sort of historic magic it has about it. So when you walk into, for example, the historic Ramsdale Theater, it has so much history and these ghosts are really present. And all of the buildings, the downtown area, everything is just so old and beautiful. The homes are Victorian. There's painted ladies everywhere. Even the, you know, like the Briney building, the Ironworks building, there's big, rich history. I feel like when I'm in Los Angeles or out in the world, I'm always trying to articulate how special I think Manistee is. Mm-hmm. So this project is really giving me a way to articulate that. There's just so many stories. And also, you know, the area is rich with the Native American history that the tribe is so integral to our area. So it's this weird juxtaposition of, you know, Native American culture, but also the Victorian era when Manistee had its boom. So I just love it. And I hope that people come to see it.
Well, it's certainly clear you're not just reading words. This is really something that, I mean, you grew up there and it still brings you back. You have your dad here with us today. So we know you have family here. You have a lot of roots in Michigan.
Absolutely. So many roots. And it's a tiny way in which I can give back. Manistee really encouraged me and supported me and told me yes all the time as a little person. And I think that having that energy as my foundation as an artist was so special. I mean, who would say that a little girl growing up in Michigan would have access to a beautiful Victorian playhouse built in 1903 and an Art Deco movie theater that's having its 80th birthday this year and a world-renowned, you know, music school at Michigan. I mean, it's just such serendipity for me. I just feel so lucky that I had that energy and love and passion and appetite for being a performer. And right in front of me were all of these adults and facilities and institutions that
led you down the
road. Led me there.
Well, enjoy your Michigan vacation,
Tony. Thank you.
Tony Trucks, thank you so much for being with us, the voice of the new Manistee Historic Sites Tours. Tony Trucks speaking to Stateside in May. She will be back next season as Lisa Davis in SEAL Team on CBS. The show got picked up for another 22 episodes. On the first day that Michael Gustafson and his wife Hillary opened Literati Bookstore in the heart of downtown Ann Arbor, something possessed him to place a typewriter on a table with some paper for anyone to use. That was in the spring of 2013. Since then, Gustafson's public typewriter experiment has yielded a treasure trove of notes, some droll, some heartbreaking, some witty, some poignant.
Life, like this typewriter, has no backspace. Type strongly and don't look back.
There is something simultaneously thrilling and terrifying about a blank page.
I love it when you talk typewriter to me.
Everyone has a superpower. The trick is to find it.
Dear Nana, you would have loved this place.
Those are just a few of the notes that Michael Gustafson has put into his new book, which he co-edited with designer Oliver Uberti, Notes from a Public Typewriter. Michael, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
Well, these notes are so fascinating, so powerful. What gave you this idea to use a corner of your bookstore for your public typewriter experiment?
You know, about 10 years ago, I inherited my grandfather's Smith Corona typewriter, and I remember I was a struggling writer at the time, and I remember using it for the first time and watching, pressing the keys and watching the hammer snap onto the white page, and it was like magic, and it made me feel connected to words and to language and also to him. He passed away when I was a kid, and I didn't really have a chance to know him. And so when my wife and I were considering opening up a bookstore here in Ann Arbor, we needed a logo, and we wanted our bookstore to embody curated, thoughtful books, curated writing. We wanted to support the kind of writing we believed in. And when you type on a typewriter, you have to self-edit. It's not like typing on a word processor where there's delete keys. Once you type something, it is on the page forever. And so there's the self-editing that happens. You have to be very thoughtful when you type on a typewriter. And we thought, well, for our logo idea for the bookstore, why not make our logo a typewriter? And so when your logo is a typewriter, obviously you put out a typewriter. And that first week we were open 5 years ago, I remember one of the first notes that was left on that typewriter was, thank you for being here. And over time, people began just leaving all kinds of notes, not just about books and bookstores, but very personal notes, very introspective notes, funny notes, sad notes, and the notes just kept accumulating.
Did the response outstrip what you thought it would be when you first put that out, or did you just want to see what happened?
We had no expectations of like how people would use it. You know, before we opened, I had this vision of the typewriter that would be this ongoing story. So if Literati was open for 30 years, we would have a 30-year-long novel where each customer would pick up where the last person left off. But I didn't like set up any prompts or anything. I just put out the typewriter because we were open. And I've just been amazed how people have used it without any kind of prompts. They've poured their souls out onto the page.
They have. Some of the notes that I really enjoyed speak to the younger generation trying to get what this typewriter thing is all about, like the one that said, if I had to write a 5-paragraph essay on this thing, I would withdraw from middle school. Or I love the comment, why does this thing have a hashtag symbol? They didn't have Twitter. Hashtag weird.
You know, we've been just amazed. Like, the typewriter experiment really began to take off when we started sharing our favorite notes on social media. And when we started sharing those notes, young people started flocking to the typewriter. It almost became this destination around Ann Arbor where people would make a – especially small kids would make a beeline straight for the typewriter. I'll never forget, like, I saw – I was in the lower level and I saw a granddaughter and a grandfather. And the granddaughter was sitting on the grandfather's lap. And they were hand in hand and reciting – they were typing together and just reciting I space L space O space V space E space Y space O space U. And in that moment when I saw that happen, it wasn't just about the words on the typewriter. There were these interactions that were happening around the typewriter. And one thing that my wife and I are always asked at Literati, opening a bookstore, what's the biggest surprise that you've had? And the biggest surprise that we always come back to, we knew people would come in and browse books and discover new reads, but we didn't anticipate the amount of interactions that people would have around those books, conversations, people on dates, families coming in, talking about new reads, new voices. And the same thing happened with the typewriter. People began to interact with it. And so this book, Notes from Public Typewriter, it has our favorite notes over the past 5 years, but it also has photographs and stories and behind-the-scenes vignettes of the interactions that we've had as well.
And the experience of running a bookstore, and you stop and you think, it's so interesting that those giant chains, the Borders and Walden Books and Barnes and Noble, rose up through the 80s and 90s and caused a lot of small independent bookstores like yours to have to close. But now Most of the biggies are gone and bookstores like yours are reemerging. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think competition, especially online competition, has gotten fierce. I think it's very expensive. The 40,000 square foot model is just too expensive for real estate and lease prices and payroll. And there's actually a resurgence happening right now for smaller independent bookstores opening up in the wake of borders closing. 2,000 to 4,000 square foot that are definitely like a tenth of the size of those big chain bookstores, but are very events focused, very community oriented, sort of third spaces for people, not work, not home, a place where people can just go.
And people like, you know, we have this sense of life being, you know, you commute to work, you're in your car, you're at work, you go home, you're on your computer or your tablet, and you're in a silo. And this is a place to come to kind of get out of the silo.
I feel digitally fatigued. And I think that's happening with a lot of people that I talk to as well. And when you go into a bookstore, I mean, especially with this typewriter project, I've been reflecting a lot about why people are coming in and leaving all these notes. And I think there's, with this digital fatigue that we're experiencing, I think with the anonymous nature of notes, your name's not attached to it. It's not attached to a platform. You're not saying anything to get any followers or likes. It's just purely the power of words. And I think a lot of people respond to that.
Well, in fact, it struck me how many of these notes are very, very deeply personal, like this one.
2 days sober. Thrilled about the first, terrified of the second. Do not have enough money to buy a book today, but I'm comfortable here. Thank you.
Or this story of a missed opportunity.
I met the man of my dreams, and I'm moving 1,000 miles away from him tomorrow.
I mean, those could be the start of a book or a screenplay, because I found myself going, what happened? Do you find yourself seeing people writing things and wanting to, or, you know, somebody writes something, you know that they wrote maybe that last one, and you see them back again? Do you want to see how things work out, or do you want to just let them be in their anonymity?
Oliver and I, the co-designer of this book and co-editor, we've been talking a lot about, do you want to know? Do you, is imagination better than truth? And I'm so glad that in this montage that you played a note, Dear Nana, you would have loved this place. The first book that we sold when the book went on sale in late March, it was at 10 in the morning and I was in the basement of Literati and somebody said, Mike, somebody wants you to sign a book. So I walked upstairs and the first customer was there said, my daughter was in New York and she saw your book out and she flipped through the book and she saw a note that she wrote. And it was, Dear Nana, you would have loved this place. And she told me the story that it happened maybe about a year ago where Nana passed away and they were all in town and she came and she wrote this note. And there's two amazing things that I took away from that. The first was that this woman said that her daughter wants to be a writer and was so proud now she's a published writer. And then the second note is that this memory of this experience and Nana has this second life on this book. And we've had a few of those interactions and it's been lovely, but it is also when you take a note like what we've done and you surround it with white on the page, you sort of frame this note as a moment in time. And these notes aren't Pulitzer Prize-winning thoughts. They're very simple. They're very authentic. But you wonder, what's the backstory? And sometimes just wondering is a fun, powerful experience.
And that, as you go through the pages of Notes from a Public Typewriter, that's exactly what I felt. Speaking of typewriters, probably America's most famous typewriter geek is Tom Hanks, who I know he is crazy for typewriters. And tell me, you actually reached out to him.
I did. I am very aware of Tom Hanks' enthusiasm for typewriters. He just wrote a book that is centered around typewriters that we sell in the store. And I thought that it was only appropriate for me to type a letter to Tom Hanks and send him the book. So I pulled out my grandfather's Smith Corona. I typed a letter to him. We sent it off. I had no expectations. This is one of the most famous people in the world. No expectations. A couple weeks later in our bookstore's inbox, there's this very unassuming letter. And I open it up and it's a typed letter from Tom Hanks. And he said, bravo. Who could pass up the opportunity to type on a public typewriter? Nobody that I would know. And it was so meaningful. It was such a great experience.
I hope that's framed.
Oh, yeah. Definitely framed.
Definitely framed. Here's one final note that really jumped out at us.
Typewriters remind us that words are sound. They make noise like the striking of keys, the scratch of pen on paper. What have we lost now that words are silent?
What did this public typewriter experiment teach you? What have we lost now that words are silent?
I think that part of the joy for this experiment has been seeing all the younger people flock to the typewriter and feel that connection that I had when I used that typewriter from my grandfather 10 years ago, this actual physical, tangible connection with words and writing. It's a great experience to write anything, but when you see those words pop into life on a white page, you're reminded of the power of words and the lasting power of words, which is really what this book is all about. And this book is an ode not only to words and language, but also to independent bookstores. And I can't thank the community enough for contributing to this book.
It's a beautiful book. Notes from a Public Typewriter, edited by Michael Gustafson and Oliver Oberti. Thank you so much for sharing it with us, and congratulations on a beautiful read.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Turning now to our ongoing series, Minding Michigan, where we focus on mental health and wellness. When do you know the time has come to seek mental health care? And where do you go? To whom do you turn? It is such a critical question in the quest for mental health and wellness, and we don't tend to think about it until there's a crisis. Let's explore this now as we welcome Michigan State University psychiatrist, Dr. Farha Abbasi. Dr. Abbasi, welcome back.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Good to have you with us. And we welcome back clinical psychologist and director of Monarch Behavioral Health in Bloomfield Hills, Dr. Julie Brakaszewski. Your patients all call you Dr. Julie, so we will too. Welcome back.
Thank you so much for having me.
So let's start right with that first question. When do we know the time has come to seek mental health care first for ourselves? What do you think, Dr. Abbasi?
The most important thing is safety. So we have to be very sure that someone who's struggling is not having thoughts of hurting themselves or hurting anyone else. So safety becomes the most important criteria. But the other things that we explore is the severity then. What symptoms you are having, how severe the symptoms are. Let's say you're feeling sad. Is it mild depression, moderate or severe? Then comes the most important factor that kind of decides when to seek treatment is also functionality. So if you are depressed, you are having these severe symptoms, thoughts of hurting yourself or hurting someone else, how is it impacting your life? Is it impacting your schoolwork, your relationships, your everyday communication? So functionality is also becomes very important to navigate how and when to seek care.
We often also, to that same point, we often look at individuals' change, both for adults and children, but a little differently. Mm-hmm. And that what has changed recently? Is their personality changing? Is it different when you're interacting with them? Is their ability to handle the daily hassles of life when the grocery cart hits your car or when somebody's late? Are you just not – has it changed that you're just not able to cope with that stress anymore? Mm-hmm. And for kids, it's a little different in that – they're developing, and they're developing over childhood and adolescence, and the definition of development is change. So it is really hard for parents and other loved ones to understand when a kid is just in a phase and when it's not a phase.
And as a parent, I know you just think you know where they're yeah. at, and they go move, because it's always a moving goalpost.
Absolutely.
When your kids are developing.
Absolutely.
And I know, Dr. Julie, your caseload is about 65% child mm-hmm. and about 35% adult. So where should that point of seeking care for a child be?
Absolutely. So we know when a kid hits a developmental milestone, they're just about to hit that milestone, they fall apart completely. And it's maddening as a parent. You see a regression in toileting, sometimes tantruming. All of a sudden they can't do their math homework. What is going on here? If it lasts for more than just a couple days to a couple weeks, time to seek help. It is not a phase.
Okay. Well, that's a good way to just to kind of wrap your mind around that. Dr. Abbasi, do you find that patients, people, wait too long before they become patients, that problems are more deeply rooted than if they had come to you sooner?
Definitely. I think when it comes to mental health, we still have a lot of stigma, a lot of misinformation. So we see a lot of denial that comes in, that this is not this. This is, like you said, it can be a phase. or he hasn't eaten, mm-hmm. or the school is hard, or, you know, the first thing we always tell the kids or the youth is, toughen up, we had it harder than you guys, you know. So there's a lot of denial initially. So I always talk about the person themselves should be able to accept that they are struggling with, be it depression or anxiety, and then somebody validating it for them. Or it could be a parent, it could be a friend, it could be a colleague, somebody kind of saying that, yes, you are acting different, you are functioning different. So that becomes very important. But definitely there's denial and very defensiveness around it.
When you think of denial, when you say that the person recognizes, let's talk about adults first, and then we'll talk about teenagers and kids. But let's say that a partner sees a change, but the other person does not buy into it, is not accepting that. What do you do then?
There are shared common goals in every life and relationship. There is usually some type of goal orientation that an individual who is distressed or has a mental health issue, they're not meeting that goal. And that's discrepant from the life that they want to live, or they know they are not living out their potential. And so you tap into that. You know, what do you want out of life, and what is getting in the way? Do you want help with right. that, with overcoming that? Here are the strategies. And then sometimes you also get a buy-in with being really specific about what you're going to do in therapy.
Okay.
We're not just going to come in and chat for a while and then you leave. Reduce the ambiguity and have a treatment plan. Get buy-in for a specific amount of sessions and also create accountability. When you leave the therapy room, what are we expecting you're going to try out and do? So that they can see the change working in their lives and buy in at least to a certain degree.
I would also like to add that one thing is not having the knowledge or information, but there's also knowing a little and creating a perjury term around it. So especially when partners are referring, it shouldn't be like, oh, you are acting so bipolar. You are so borderline. I think people listen and hear these words on media, in TV shows, magazines, but they don't really understand what it means. So when you are trying to bring a family member or a kid to the treatment, you don't say, you are acting crazy, you are acting bipolar. You know, that's something I always talk to parents, and especially, you know, in couples, if you are referring yeah. your husband, wife, or a partner, you have to be very respectful and thoughtful of the way you are using these terms.
So give us some phrases. Let's play act a little bit. What would you say to me if I'm a parent of a resistant teenager that just doesn't want anything to do with going to therapy, but I'm making that kid come?
The most important thing is assuring them of your love for them, validating their struggle. Other thing is the kids would say think like, oh, you want me to go to college or you want me to do this. It becomes our goals that we want the kids to be like this trophy or you are not doing well in school. It shouldn't come out like, oh, your classes are getting affected. It should be, I'm invested in you. I'm concerned about you. I'm worried about you. So once the kids are validated and heard and listened to, the rapport has to be, the trust has to be established.
Absolutely. Coming from that foundation of love and care. And as parents, we often get tripped up in the distress that we're feeling as parents. We feel really anxious. Our child is suffering. So it feels dangerous or scary. And then that emotional experience informs our communication. And then we clamp down. And instead, in those moments, it's very effective to think, how much do I love my child? What do they want to get out of life? Are they not performing? Mm-hmm. Are they crying on the sidelines every game? Are they coming home in tears when it comes down to tests? Is that what's going on? Well, they don't want to be experiencing that. So coming from that foundation of love, absolutely, and validating with empathic words rather than labeling words.
Right.
I see those tests are hard for you. Let's make them easier. I see, oh, man, when that coach is yelling from the sidelines, you take it to heart because you care so much. I wonder if there's ways we can deal with that to make it so it's not so distressing
yeah.
and do a lot of that wondering, a lot of I wonder if somebody can help us with this so that you feel like you are a team with your child rather than pushing them. It's not your goal. It is their goal. But you are facilitating it because you love them so much.
And it sounds like you can take everything that you've both said without much difficulty and adapt that for our adult relationships.
Absolutely.
As well. Mm-hmm. If you've just joined us, we are talking about when you know the time has come to seek mental health care and where you go. As we talk with clinical psychologist Dr. Julie Brakaszewski, director of the Monarch Behavioral Health in Bloomfield Hills, and Michigan State University psychiatrist Dr. Farah Abbasi. So this is great chance for me to ask this question. We're going to do a little compare and contrast because before me is an MD psychiatrist and a PhD clinical psychologist. So, Dr. Abbasi, what can a psychologist like Dr. Julie offer to patients?
I'm a big proponent of prescribing and combining it with therapy. The clinical psychologist or therapist play an immensely important role because they are the ones who sustain this person day in, day out, weekly basis, while the psychiatrist then follow up monthly or maybe twice a month, something like that.
Okay. And so, Dr. Julie, how do you fit a psychiatrist into what kind of care plan you might design?
It's incredibly important to be teamed up with a psychiatrist that you trust and know and have that working relationship with. You know, we do see individuals who do not need medication, but many do. And being able to refer out is extremely important for the medical treatment. Emotions, mood, some behaviors are very neurobiological basis. So when an individual is coming in and engaging in their treatment protocol and they're doing the skill building and understanding their thinking patterns, emotional patterns, but they're not making progress, they may need a foundation of neurobiological help to springboard and use all of those skills that they're working so hard to develop. They may need a little bit of help. I think it's also useful to take a step back and think about the different training and training style, because so often, at least 20 times a week, we get calls at our office for a psychiatrist. We want to talk to Dr. Julie, the psychiatrist, and I have to back away and say, oh, that's not what I do. I do not prescribe. If you come in, we can do a diagnostic evaluation, and we can absolutely work on a diagnosis. We can do testing and psychoevaluation, and we can do treatment, but I do not prescribe. A psychiatrist goes to medical school and specializes in psychiatry.
So let's say I realize that I do need to see a mental health professional. What do I do to find the right one?
I think we all are an entry point.
Absolutely.
So somebody can be referred to a psychiatrist initially or a clinical psychologist.
Well, let's say I look up a clinic. I'm surfing on the web because I've decided I need to go. I pick a name. I wait for an appointment. I finally get there. And then I get the feeling that this therapist and I are not going to click. Do either of you offer prospective patients a chance for a get acquainted meeting, or dare I say, a test drive?
Absolutely. And many clinicians do. It has to be limited in nature just because of, quite honestly, the legalities of understanding what treatment is and signing kind of information, protected information documents. And oftentimes that is involved in a full intake evaluation. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, most clinicians will meet with people for small intervals and especially have phone conversations so you can get a chance to understand their personality and communication style. And during our intakes, we really stress that clinician match is very important. If I remind you of your hated Aunt Hilda, you are not going to do well in therapy with me. And that is totally fine. We have a lot of colleagues we can refer to. So if my communication style or personality just doesn't hit the mark, that is fine.
Yeah, I'm sure that's got to be very important. And then how do you know when you're done?
I think for me personally, as a psychiatrist, we have a very fast turnover. Mm-hmm. We have to keep that in mind. And the basic thing that we are looking at is, are you stable on your meds? So initially, the medication doses might be higher. You might be using a combination of meds. But then as you start to function better, the goal is to bring you down to the lowest effective level maintenance doses. Mm-hmm. So I think for me, functionality, but also having that insight of, let's say somebody is suffering from bipolar. Mm-hmm. Are they aware what to look for, what red flags to look for, when to see that they are going through a relapse, when they are getting hypomanic? So all those insight and safety, again.
Sure.
Absolutely. And in the therapeutic context, hopefully you have a set of goals. When those goals are met, as much as I enjoy seeing the individuals that I work with, I am exuberant when I don't see them anymore. Or right. I run into them at the grocery store and I haven't seen them in 3 months. And it's because they're doing wonderfully. When you've met your goals, you're done. Some people do need maintenance therapy.
Yeah, to continue to tune up.
Absolutely. And continue to, am I using the skills in the way that I intend to? Am I keeping up with my goals? And sometimes we'll drop down to even just once a month. Right. Once, you know, bi-monthly to do the check-in of that functioning. So we know, do we need to refer back to your psychiatrist? Do you need a change in meds? What is going on here? Do you need thyroid testing? Let's go back to your PCP, your primary care physician, which is also a great entry point.
Entry point, right.
Yeah.
Very much so.
So you're done when you meet your goals, but we say goodbye with an open door.
Okay. Right. The word stigma, we always wind up using that word when we talk about mental health and wellness. So how do you destigmatize that process of therapy for that patient who perhaps is reluctant to come to see you or doesn't want people to know that they're coming to see Dr. Julie or Dr. Abbasi? How do you destigmatize it?
There are lots of different levels. And one is with the individual to try and get a sense of where is their stigmatization coming from? Is it very personal? Are they experiencing a lot of guilt and shame? Is it familial? Is it cultural? Is it more at the society level? And try to speak to that hot button, that kind of, if you think of like an underground river that's flowing, where is that coming from for them? And then address that issue. And you can use, like you were speaking earlier about important language, not using diagnoses as labels for people.
Right.
Also, mental health issues are normal. Everyone experiences them throughout their life. In the past year, over 20% of individuals have experienced a major mental health illness.
Right.
But only just below half of those individuals will get treatment. And then children and adolescents, it's only about 76%, I think, they don't get treatment. 76% of children and adolescents with mental health needs do not get treatment.
And I think how I look at it is whenever we have secrecy about something, secrecy leads to shame, shame leads to stigma. And one other thing, important thing to understand is that we have to promote the disease model with the mental illness, that it is a biopsychosocial struggle. It is like any other disease out there. So you are not ashamed when you get the diagnosis of diabetes. You are worried, you are anxious, but you are not ashamed of being called diabetic. It becomes harder when you're saying you are depressed or you are bipolar. So I think we have to be able to have conversations like this, create more awareness, and give it more visibility.
And if I can piggyback on the diabetes parallel, we often use that in our office,
right,
that medical model, in that, you know, there's a spectrum of, you know, type 1, type 2, how the body is functioning. But no matter the spectrum of diabetes that you are diagnosed with, there has to be behavioral change as well as often emotional change. You have to keep your stress low. So that is a great medical correlate to mental health issues, that when you're speaking with loved ones, you can use that and say, would you tell somebody to not go to a doctor and to not use insulin when they have diabetes?
Right.
Well, that wouldn't be fair. You need both. You need the complementary, the medical perspective, as well as the behavioral and the emotional perspective on that.
Well, it has been wonderful getting insights from both of you. We've been talking with Dr. Julie Brakaczewski, who's clinical psychologist and director of Monarch Behavioral Health in Bloomfield Hills. Dr. Julie, thank you so much. And Michigan State University psychiatrist, Dr. Farah Abbasi, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
And a special thanks for continuing this conversation.
Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstrom. Contributors are Mike Blank, Mercedes Mejia, Lindsay Scullin, and April Van Buren. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.